Welcome to the BookTree podcast. What should your kids and teens be reading next? To answer that question, we'll be interviewing authors and illustrators, publishers and literacy experts, and other bookish people. We'll also look at current book news and trends and discuss issues around reading and writing. We'll look at the most burning question on all our minds: how do we get kids to read in these screen-obsessed times? Hosted by me, Corinne Rosmarin, journalist and writer, this is a home for all things books, children's and parents' books. After all, children become readers when they see their parents reading too. Come and join us, and let's find out what your kids and you should be reading next.
Welcome to the BookTree podcast.
Hello and welcome, Lauriane Preston. I'm so happy to be talking to you today. For those of you who don't know, Lauriane is one of South Africa's most loved and successful children's book authors. She has a unique ability to mix silliness and humor, wit, and some of the best name puns I've ever read, relatable characters, and naughty anti-heroes. Out of this world comes adventure and limitless imagination. Lauriane is going to tell us briefly about your career as a teacher and how it started you off on this path of writing.
Okay, well, thank you so much for inviting me today. I really appreciate it. So when I was 20, I actually opened an educare center. Well, then it was called a daycare. I did a course with the health department and started a tiny little play school in my parents' back garden.
Wow, I didn't know
for children. Yeah, so for children aged 2 to 4 years old. And the educare grew and grew and grew over the years. And eventually I sold the school when I was 28. And the school had grown to 60 children at that stage. And I had quite a few employees. And I was exhausted because I actually started at the age of 19. Wow. 10 years of owning an educare. And I never took a holiday in 10 years. So for 10 years solid, every school holiday, I would run a children's holiday club.
Wow.
So no holiday for the first 10 years, all my 20s.
That's very dedicated. And you obviously had a passion for early learning.
Yeah, and you know what? I absolutely loved it. Absolutely loved it. And of course, every single day, the children would get a story read to them at the end of the day, or a few stories. So you can imagine how many stories I have read over the years, thousands and thousands. So I sold the educare, and then I actually started repping for my husband for 5 years, selling ice cream and wine.
Nice detour.
But I always had a calling, you know, to be a like proper qualified teacher. So I went and spoke to the principal at Clarendon Prep School, Bev Keith, and I told her about my dream. And she took me into Clarendon, into their learnership program, Clarendon Prep School. So while I studied through UNISA, I taught speech and drama at Clarendon to the grade R's up to grade 3. And then I studied and I got qualified. So I got my Bachelor of Education through UNISA, cum laude. I'm very proud of that.
Amazing. That's great.
And then
all
I went
way around.
Yeah. And then I went across and I taught at Beaconhurst, and I taught grade R and a little bit of grade 2 at Beaconhurst and Beaconhurst Primary School in East London. And I actually went on and I even did my honours. So I have my honours degree through that. So it's never too late to, I always say that it's never too late to start studying. I started studying in my 30s and I did my honours in my 40s.
So that was the school side of it. And then so that was about, from what I understand, about 20 years of working in that field.
Yeah, in education. While I was reading to the grade 2s at Beaconhurst, I was reading Horrid Henry to them and Roald Dahl. And that's when I came across a need for my class to read a book written by a South African author that was really relatable content, because our humor in South Africa is really, really funny. And I went to, we don't have an exclusive books in East London. I went to Bargain Books and couldn't find what I was looking for, you know, a chapter book for my class. And I did a Google search to see if I could find anything in Africa that I could order online for my class to enjoy, and came across the writing competition, the Golden Babo Prize. So that was in 2016. And so I entered the competition and I thought, well, you know what? I've always wanted to be a writer since I was 8 years old. Let me try and enter. And I entered 2 picture book stories and then the chapter story, The Amazings. And I ended up winning that competition and got some really, really good prize money. So I was super excited. And that obviously gave me confidence in my ability as a writer. And then I asked the children in my class, what did they want to read about. And they made it very clear that they said, ma'am, just make sure it's funny. They want a funny book and they want a great adventure. So that's when I thought, okay, the Amazings. So the Amazings is actually a group of children who go exploring the Kango Caves. So it's really great, fun adventure story. And then, yeah, from that, my mom actually got really ill. My mom got motor neuron bulbar palsy disease. So I actually resigned from teaching to be with her for her last year. And at that time, I continued to write, and I was actually just writing my honors then as well. So I was with her at that time and carried on writing. And that's when I wrote Tybal the Space Dude. Now, I mean, for me, it was a no-brainer because Tybal the Space Dude, I'm a huge Star Wars fan and love anything to do with space. And that's when I started with Tybal.
And what I love about the story of Tybal, because I remember actually someone gifted it to me with my children when they were young, is just that discovery of a really South African hero. It was a story set on Mars, so it's out of this world, literally, but the language, the humor, the context of their adventure and their family and how they went on this adventure was so South African. It was amazing.
Thanks. Yeah. When I wrote it, I wasn't sure, you know, if it was any good either. So I actually went back to the school I taught at, Beaconhurst, and I met with a group of beta readers at break time. I had to bribe them with like milkshakes and chocolate milkshakes and sweets, because obviously they were giving up their break time. And every break I would write and go in and read just to see if my jokes were landing and, you know, if they found it humorous, if it was working. And so I really appreciated that group of children. And then, yeah, the inspiration for the character Tybal actually came from one of the children that I taught. I taught him in grade R and once again in grade 2. And he knows who he is.
Oh, lovely.
I think he's in high school now.
Yeah, that's a lovely story. I'm sure he could actually keep a copy of the book and show his children.
I bumped into him in one of the shopping centers and he was like, Mrs. Preston! And he gave me a big hug and he said, I'm Tybal. Hey, I am Tybal. And I'm like, yes, you are.
Love it.
His name isn't Tybal, though.
Okay. And then, so then we move on to, so Tybal has 3 books in the series. And then did you write Trixie at the same time, or was that when you'd finished with Tybal?
When I wrote Tybal, I couldn't find a traditional publisher for Tybal. But I I submitted it to quite a few publishing houses, and you know how it goes, you get your rejection letter.
Yeah.
I actually got a really nice rejection letter from a publishing house in Australia. Also, yeah, I mean, South African publishing houses as well. I mean, they're not nice things to receive at all. But one thing you do have to be as a writer is persistent. You have to keep trying. And I really believed in Tybal. So I first self-published the book. So I wasn't sure how on earth to do this. But with the prize money that I got from the Amazings, I used that money to fly to Cape Town. And I actually met with Quick Fox Publishing. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Quick Fox Publishing.
Yes, I've heard of them.
Yeah. And they are absolutely incredible. They're amazing. As a team, they really know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And I self-published Tybal. And my husband, he believed in this as well. And we printed, which I would definitely never recommend to anyone, but we printed 1,000 copies.
Okay.
Print 100. See how it goes.
And for those who don't understand what the publishing landscape looks like in South Africa, I think that if you sell 2,000, you are a bestseller. Is that right?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. So
it's really hard to sell books.
Because you say 1,000, and I would think, well, that makes sense. 1,000 easily. Why wouldn't you print 1,000 until you actually try to sell each book?
Exactly. But I was lucky because you've got to go and market your own book, obviously, as a self-published author, an indie author. There is so much to learn about the publishing world. I promise you, it is a lot. And it takes time to learn all the different words and how it all works. I was lucky as a teacher because I really had a market. And I think that's one of the big things. You need to have a market. So first of all, I held a book launch in February of 2018. And invited teachers from the schools I taught and friends. And I sold 80 copies at my launch.
That's good. Cool.
Yeah. Really nice friends and family. I provided snacks. And I had like little gummy bookworms for everyone. It was lots of fun. Then I went to Clarendon and spoke at Clarendon Primary. And the girls bought 100 copies. It was the school I went to. I had that incredible support. Then I went across to another school in East London, Stirling, and they bought 80 copies, and then Hudson. And then I just kept going and visiting schools. But I think what writers and authors should do when they visit schools is you can't make it all about your book, because you can't just go in and self-promote. I think you've got to make your visit, well, I mean, you obviously can, but just go in and self-promote your book. And I mean, you are doing a reading, and so it's educational, obviously. But I structured my visits so that I held a mini workshop for the children, a writing workshop. So I would actually do a little, well, I still do. I actually was at a school yesterday and we did it. Yesterday, I visited Preston Primary, the grade four. I take children through the process of creating a story.
I think that this is really interesting because I obviously invited you to talk about your latest book, which is Trixie, and we'll get back to that. But I do think what's so important is that there are a lot of wannabe writers out there, both young children who want to write and adults who want to write, and they want to write children's books. And I think that there's a lot of misconception around how easy it will be to find a publisher and to get your book out there. It's not enough to have a great book, as you've proved, because Taboo was a wonderful story. It was well written. It was definitely waiting for the right market. But obviously the publishers at that point didn't see how it would fit, or for whatever reasons they had. You don't always know what the publishers are looking for either. So I suppose sometimes you have to convince them by going ahead and showing them that there actually is a market. You've already sold your own book. So that's really your story, right? Because you first self-published, proved that you had a market, and then you were offered a contract. Which book got the contract with the publisher?
Tower did, which is very unusual that a self-published book will then be taken on to be traditionally published. As I understand it, it's an unusual thing to happen. So I self-published Tower, the first one and the second one. And then I self-published Trixie. That was 2018, 2019. And then I was set to be traditionally published. So what I did do was I obviously networked. And once I'd kind of exhausted all the schools in East London, I contacted schools in Cape Town and said, hey, can I come visit? And visited schools in Cape Town. And also in KwaZulu-Natal, I connected with Angela from Books to You and visited some schools there. And then my name kind of got around. And I think definitely with also a bit of luck, because one of the schools I visited in Cape Town, the librarian was friends with somebody who worked at LAPA Publishers. And also when I was in KwaZulu-Natal, there were two book agents, well, book, yeah, sellers, who I went and visited and said, hey, I believe you know, are distributors. And they were also familiar with LAPA Publishers. And so those distributors, and then the word kind of got around that, hey, children are reading Laurie Anne's books and they're enjoying them. And that's when I flew to Cape Town and I had a very fancy meeting with the team at LAPA Publishers. We went to Stellenbosch, one of the wine estates, and had lunch together. And they said, you know, stay in through and we'll have a look and read the books. And then I was very, very lucky and fortunate that they took me on as one of the authors. But I will say, you know, when it comes to writing books, everyone should have a go at it, writing their own book. And as I say, if you can't get it traditionally published, try. But then, you know, self-publish and, you know, keep trying. But I will say, if it was something that was easy to do, everyone would be doing it. Writing stories for children is tricky. It's not as easy as you might think. I mean, when you sit down and actually now write the story from beginning to the end, it's hard work.
So let's get on to your latest book, which is Trixie 2. As I said to you, I really loved the character arc. So I loved Trixie and the introduction of her in the first book. For those who don't know, Trixie is a lovable, hilariously naughty trickster. She's always up to some funny tricks and playing tricks in her class. And the story obviously hit the right note with young audiences. Trixie is a hilarious character. She's at a school. Her teacher is called Miss Lunatic. Her primary school is called Misery Primary School, M-I-Z-Z-E-R-Y. And this teacher seems to secretly or openly hate children. She has rules against joking, laughing, or smiling in class. She, in fact, even says no blowing your nose in class. And I can imagine all the children reading this thinking this is an awful teacher. How dare she? So when Trixie does play her tricks, they're all cheering her on. What I also like about the book is that you're not too shy to say some things that might not be seen as not PC these days, which, for example, is having the this nerd character, Barry Schmelly. He's written about in a way that makes him the class nerd, but he's also very irritating because he seems to always take the teacher's side. How did you tread that fine line between not victimizing him as a nerd and letting the children laugh at and with him? It's a fine line, right?
Well, I mean, nerds are cool. They're absolutely cool. Yeah, obviously, I think we do get a bit of allowance as writers to bring comedy into our books. So the focus I had with Trixie is I wanted to make it as funny as possible. So that's how I kind of really exaggerated the characters. And yeah, I think as a teacher, you're 100% correct. I mean, calling a teacher Miss Lunatic is not okay. So already there are teachable moments. As soon as you start the book, children will laugh and I can get away with it because that's what I've achieved my goal. I'm entertaining children and they're reading the book and they want to read more. I've already grabbed their attention. And a teacher can be like, is this okay to say? And immediately have a teachable moment there. I think I just went for it. You know, I didn't put too much thought into the characters being portrayed as stereotypical or whatever. I just thought, let me just have fun with it, have as much fun as possible. And I think that's why kids enjoy it.
I know, that's what I was about to say. I think that today we are very careful and nervous about crossing lines, but sometimes it's just what children want. It allows them to express something that they don't feel they can express in their own lives. Fiction makes it safe. Or adults as well. You know, you think about how we love to watch movies about bank heists and people who do things that are against the law. It's exploring a darker side of life, but in a safe way.
Yes, for sure. You know, the things in the book, I try to make my books as relatable to children as possible. So the way I bring a lot of humor into my books is through dialogue. So I really, whenever I visit schools, like as I say yesterday, when I was listening to the children talk, I immediately try and bring in the way they talk to each other into the books. So I always say, like in South Africa, when the children greet each other, the boys, even heard it yesterday, they go, how's it, my bro? And I always try and bring in and they call each other, hey, you know, hey, dude, how's it going? And try and keep it very relaxed and very relatable. And I think that's where the children absolutely love the books because they're like, oh my goodness, that's so funny.
It is so funny. And I also like the way, I mean, I looked at some of the ways that you list all the tricks that Trixie has in the one part of Trixie 2. And she has brilliant tricks from which she can choose. Fake vomit, plastic fangs, water squirting flowers, plastic doggy doo-doo, snakes in cans, whoopee cushions. These tricks would surely mean a lot of laughter and a few surprises. It's good natured in a way, you know, it's not mean fun. It's all naughty, but there's nothing mean about it. And really, Trixie is trying to make her friends laugh. And I love that part about her because it's almost like you've made her a hero for wanting to make her classmates happy. And I do remember those kids in class who would constantly get shouted at by the teacher, you know, stop fooling around, you know, the class clown, in effect.
Yes, yes.
And so you've turned her into this character. We start to understand her. We see her motivations and why she does what she does.
I mean, the character of Miss Lunatic as well. I mean, Miss Lunatic doesn't hate children. She's just like super, super strict. Super, super strict. Yeah, the inspiration of Trixie actually came from my husband. I was trying to think of a new idea. You know, when he was a tween, he loved the Beano comics and he loved Dennis and Nasha. So that's where he said that was his favorite thing to read. And Dennis the Nashiner got up to all sorts of tricks. So I was like, okay, that's a clever idea. I'm going to make a Trixie and she's going to have a pet pig called Gobbler. You know, in children's books, I mean, with all the Roald Dahl books as well, the characters are completely over the top. So I didn't want to try and make my characters too over the top. I still wanted to try and keep it, you know, that they are not too crazy.
I actually think it's an amazing balance that you've achieved because you have to get that balance right. If the child is too naughty or seen as a baddie, then they won't relate to her or him. And then I want to just bring in the character arc that without giving any spoilers, but what is interesting with Trixie in this is that she does start to realize that, well, she almost matures a bit and realizes that learning and working at school might not be such a bad thing. As long as she can still play her tricks, of course. Yes. Do you think that children want to see their familiar naughty character realize the error of her ways? How did you handle that?
Yes, I thought that I needed to put that in just to keep all the teachers and parents very happy. I mean, yes, you can get up to mischief and you can play a trick, but at the end of the day, you have to put in some hard work and put some effort into your schoolwork. And I think that's also, important for children to see as well. It can't all be all fun and game. We actually do need to get some work done here.
Yeah, no, I think you did it in a really a clever way. It doesn't make you feel like the fun has ended.
Some of the tricks in the books I've done myself. I mean,
Oh.
my two brothers and I, yeah, we were always playing tricks. And one of the tricks in the book also was my editor's idea, which I think was brilliant. She suggested the permanent marker on the board, which I thought was a fun thing to add.
I love
And, I draw from my childhood quite a bit. So in Trixie, when she goes to the camp out, and the story that she tells her friends at the camp out is actually a bedtime story that my dad used to tell me as a child. And sometimes I would get a fairy story from my dad at bedtime, but sometimes it was like a scary story. So that was actually one of the stories he would tell me.
And there's like an amazing enjoyment in being scared, right? Kids love that feeling. Tell us a scary story. And then you'd always have some children who couldn't bear it and they would leave. And then the others were like, no, it has to get worse. It's like the darkness in that.
When I was teaching drama at Clarendon, I actually told the story to the children. It's part of the drama lesson, just told them the scary story. Oh my goodness. But obviously, I played it up and made it very dramatic. And they ran screaming from the hall. And the teachers were like, I was like, oh no, I'm going to be in so much trouble here. So I have watered it down. I've learned. Don't make it too scary.
Well, that's the joy of having a beta reader, right? Is that you can see, okay, this actually works, maybe too well.
I like to laugh a lot when I read, and that's what I'm hoping I'll achieve with the children as well. That they will just develop an absolute love for reading and want to read the next book and want to keep going.
And that's really the goal at the end of the day, is just to get children reading, because we know that that's our
Yeah.
battle we're facing, is to get children to love reading. It's my passion, and I can see it's yours as well.
Yes, completely.
Lorianne, thank you so much for joining us today. It's so exciting to be talking to you about your new book, and you'll have to keep us posted about the new books that are coming after this. Are there more stories coming in the Trixie series?
So there aren't any books planned for Trixie as yet. In the publishing world, you're basically going to wait like a year and a half to 2 years from your book being accepted to your book being published. So I've just signed a contract now for a book that's going to be published next year, July. And then there are plans for a book that's going to come out, a little series that'll come out towards the end of next year. There are things in the pipeline, and yeah, hopefully Trixie will become a series.
As long as we know you'll keep on writing, I know the children will be thrilled. And I'll have reviews of those books up on my website, so anyone listening can go to
Ah, thank you.
definitely.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
It's time to dive into the pages of the book review.
Okay, time for some book reviews. I have received a whole lot of lovely books, and I'm very excited to share them with you. The first one, which is probably my best picture book this year, and that's saying a lot, but I really am that excited about it. It's called Big Shoes to Fill. It's written by a South African actress, writer, and voiceover artist called Upile Utixo Bonko. Apologies for the pronunciation. And it's illustrated by Zanelda MacDonald. This picture book is very special. It teaches about resilience, identity, and family love. And it's proudly South African. And the story starts with a young boy called Zinzo. He lives with his grandfather, Tamakulu, and every morning before he goes to school, his grandfather helps him to polish his shoes. He makes quite a big deal about it. And he always says to his grandson, "Remember, you have big shoes to fill." And he's confused by this. He thinks, does he have to fill his grandfather's shoes? Does he have to fill his dad's shoes? He's not sure, but his parents, we're told, have moved to the city, and Zinzo doesn't get to see them often, which makes him very sad, but he's very determined to make them proud. His grandfather is a wonderful role model. He always sees him helping everyone with their groceries, their gardening. He talks to the people that nobody else in the village will speak to. So he's raised with a lot of respect and an understanding of helping people in his community. The story really gets going when Zinzo is told he has to give an oral about his role models. And his Mkulu helps him to make a poster with pictures of his favorite people in the world, which are his two dads. So he practices the speech. He says it while he's doing the dishes, brushing his teeth, falling asleep. And I love this little images of him doing all these things. It reminds me of when my children would practice their orals and would have to listen to them at the dinner table and in the car. Anyway, the day dawns where Zinzo goes to school. He's so excited. He stands up in front of the whole class and he gives his speech. But something's wrong. The children start to laugh. Some of them look away. Some of them are hiding their faces from him. He's so embarrassed. He runs out the classroom all the way home to his grandfather and sobs. And he says, "They all laughed at me. Why did they do that?" And his grandfather answers wisely, "They are just not used to the idea of having two fathers. It's uncommon in our community. They laughed because they were confused." And I think this is such a beautifully emotionally intelligent way of dealing with diversity and discrimination, is to understand why sometimes people do laugh. They're uncomfortable and they don't understand. And in these times where the LGBTQI plus community is only growing, we need these kind of books that, you know, they work as a starting point for discussions. The next day, Zinzo walks back into the classroom with a much braver heart, and he says his speech in front of all the children. He tells the class, "My dads are kind, thoughtful, and gentle, and they are an example of living truthfully, even if their honesty is strange to others. When I look at them, I know I have big shoes to fill." This is such a beautiful story, and it's such an important story to be told. I really would encourage everyone to get a copy of this for their children age 5+. It is available in isiXhosa, isiZulu, English, and Afrikaans. In these crazy times in the world, we just need more stories like this that just stand out as beacons of acceptance and understanding and kindness. This book leaves big shoes to fill, and I can't wait to see what Yopile writes next. Our next story is written by Elizabeth Laird, and it's called The Garbage King. It's a really beautiful and inspiring book based on the true story of an African childhood lived on the streets of Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. And it will take you on an unforgettable emotional journey. I would say it's recommended for ages 12 to 15, but you can have advanced readers from age 10 up. The story follows a young boy called Mamo, who is living in a shack with his sister Tigist, and they have been left destitute when their mother dies. One day his sister goes out looking for work, and a man arrives and says that he is his uncle, and he's going to take him to help him find some work. So Mamo goes gratefully, thinking he's going to have a new job. But the man turns out to be a child trafficker. Quite a harrowing story. And Mamo is taken out of the city and sold to a farmer. And from there, it really is quite hard reading because you see scenes of him being beaten and underfed. And Mamo feels like he's been neglected and abandoned and gets to the point where he thinks his soul is almost leaving his body. But luckily, something in him, a will to live, kicks in. And he finds a way of finding that resilience deep, deep down. He runs away and he gets back into the city. And when he arrives there, he very luckily runs into an old friend who has now joined a street gang, which sounds worse than it is. It sounds like it's a violent gang, but actually they're just a group of ragtag kids who have combined together to protect themselves and to look after each other. At the same time as we're hearing Mamo's story, we're also getting the story of another young boy. He's also a runaway, but coming from a very different background. His name is Danny. He is rich and educated, but he has his own problems, and he has to flee his tyrannical father. His mother is ill. She's been sent to England for some tests and some medical care for her heart, and his father has threatened to have him sent to almost like a military camp because Danny has got many learning issues. He's not unintelligent. He just battles with a lot of his subjects. Anyway, Danny is on the street because he decides that he would rather live on the street and be free than be sent off for this military training. And the two boys join up and they're so different. There's so many beautiful scenes of how Danny is expecting to be fed and Mamo comes with a piece of crust of bread and Danny, without thinking, grabs the bread and eats it. And Mamo looks at him and thinks, did no one teach him any manners? Does no one ever taught him? So it's almost turning that idea around that rich, educated people have the manners. It's actually the poor child who can see that when you have a little bit of food, you should share it. Through all the experiences that the children go through, their loyalty and their friendship become these shining beacons that see them through. It's a rich and powerful story. It'll make your young readers think about how children live in other parts of the world. It also humanizes the many nameless young beggars that you see on the streets, and it makes you reconsider your attitudes to those who seem dangerous, dirty, or bad. We grow to love Danny and Mamo. They are absolute heroes, and we root for them and all the children in the gang to find their own homes. The writing style is easy and descriptive. It'll keep your young readers enthralled, and they will be so keen to find out what happens to the two unlikely friends. I thought that the characters were also very well created. They felt that they were actual children living on the streets, and when I read the backstory to the author, she did base them on children she knew while she was living in Addis Ababa. She is a best-selling writer and teacher. She's lived all over the world, and her travels have influenced her style of writing and choice of topics. She's well known for tackling a range of stories that cover global issues, such as refugees and the marginalized children in society. As a parent's note, I would just say that the story deals with slave labor, child abuse, child beggars, and even death on the streets, and it also hints at prostitution. Life on the streets and for poor people with no agency is shown in detail, but it's balanced by the camaraderie and the good people who do show up, from the kind farmer who looks after Mamo when he's beaten, to the truck driver who helps him to drive to freedom and remembers his own tale of slavery. It's quite shocking to think that child slavery exists in this day and age, and it is an eye-opener, but I think for that reason it's a very important book, and it does balance the hardship, as I say, with a beautiful, powerful story. Originally published in 2003, I got this copy from my library, but I do see that Pan Macmillan have brought out updated versions with great covers. So check out your library or your local bookstore. My last review is actually not for a children's book or a parent's book. It's for a new medium that I am really mad about. It's called Substack. If you're asking what is Substack, not everyone has heard of it. It's a online platform that allows writers, journalists, and any content creator really to publish newsletters, almost like a blog of the olden days. It's subscription-based, but you can also choose a subscription where there's no payment. You just don't get the full house of offerings. And it's a fantastic tool for authors to create and share their ideas, their writing. What makes Substack so enticing is that it is basically a newsletter that you're sending out to people who want to read it. It's not like you're trying to hope that, you know, somebody will find it. What happens is when you find one Substack you like, you automatically get exposed to the people that they follow, and it suggests people for you. So you can link, you know, you go into their links and you find people that way. Therefore, it's really finding those little niche authors or people that you might not have found on Instagram just because the algorithm seems to have messed up so badly. A big part of social media is people talking about what they do, their work, but it's really disheartening when you spend so much time creating posts and you get maybe 5 likes. And it's not just because people don't like what you're doing. Well, you hope not. It's actually because they haven't seen it. There's been an explosion in newsletters lately, and Substack is leading the charge. Creators can share things on their own terms with the people who are interested enough to subscribe. So I'm going to share with you the 5 or 6 top Substacks that I've been subscribing to. And the first one is run by 2 children's book authors. Mac Barnett and John Clarkson run the Substack, Looking at Picture Books. If you don't know these authors, and you should, Mac Barnett is the author of such bestsellers as The First Cat in Space, The First Cat in Space 8 Pizza series, John's Turn about a boy ballerina, the Kid Spy series, etc. John Clarkson should need no introduction. He is the author of I Want My Hat Back, This Is Not My Hat, and The Rock from the Sky. And together they talk about all things picture books. They'll look at themes such as picture books don't have to moralize to be meaningful. The other stories they look at is, you know, books that are classics, and they will literally analyze them from page to page to see why they were so powerful. Together, the two of them are fun, irreverent, and very insightful. The next Substack that I'm really enjoying is called Zoe Sees, and it's spelled Zoe Sees, S-E-E-S. It's based on a cartoonist and illustrator, and her actual surname is S.I. Her newsletter is a mix of pulled from real-life comics, travelogues, and all her work in progress. Follow Zoe Sees for the illustrations alone. The next one is called Incidental Comics. It's by a cartoonist, author, and illustrator called Grant Snyder. It's quite an introspective newsletter, looking at the big questions of life, but also being playful and making the potentially heavy topics feel quite light. Next, we've got Am I Doing This Right by Leanne Cho. She's quite new on the picture book illustrating scene. Her newsletter is full of funny and heartfelt personal comics and the process through her life. She's an absolute delight. Again, I love her illustrations. I'll end off with Know Yourself, Do the Work by author Julie Filatko. I really love this one, especially because I'm a writer myself. She shares her writing life. She looks at how she, you know, manages to avoid distractions when she's doing the hard work of writing. And this is a huge problem for anyone who's a creative being. She says that she writes a newsletter for us, but also for herself, because she has the habit of thinking that if she promotes her books, pleases the algorithms, makes videos, does all the extra swag, that's going to be enough. But actually, it's just procrastination, masquerading as productivity. What she has to do first is write the books. And this really resonates with me because I can get very excited about the end goal rather than just sitting down and getting the work done. So I follow her because she's inspiring and because she's a good reminder for me. I hope you get onto Substack. Everybody's getting onto it. You'll find that most of your favorite authors and columnists are now on Substack. And I almost feel like you have to ride the wave before you get left behind. Thank you for joining us at the Book Tree Podcast. I love chatting to author Lorianne Preston about her writing process and her inspiration. She's such a generous and down-to-earth author. Please sign up and follow us and let us know what you'd like to hear about next. Until then, happy reading.